Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week I'll be talking with Paul Andrews of the Slavyanka Chorus about the group's upcoming performances of Rachmaninoff's Vespers. Also, some folks from the Marilla Opera Program are here. Gene Kellogg, the executive director, and Mojo, apprentice stage director, will be talking about the grand finale of Marilla this coming Saturday. I'll also speak with violinist Jeff Nuttall of the St. Lawrence String Quartet about the quartet's upcoming European tour with the San Francisco Symphony. Plus, Peter Robinson will be by with a movie review and some suggestions for reading in the changing nature of today's libraries. Stay with us. A little touch of Puccini for you on Open Air from La Rondine, Bevo al tuo fresco sorriso. Those were last year's Marilini, including Elizabeth Baldwin, Jennifer Cherist, Casey Candabat, and Joshua Baum, along with the full Marilini contingent singing in the chorus on that excerpt from Puccini. Well, opera lovers are in for a treat this Saturday as the grand finale of the Marilla Opera program is being presented at the War Memorial Opera House at 7:30 on this coming Saturday. Staged performances and scenes from Tchaikovsky, Verdi, Bellini, Hoffmann, Jake Heggie, Offenbach, Mascagni, Humperdinck, Gounod and Rossini, among others. And here to talk about the grand program, KLW is a media sponsor of the performance, by the way, is Jean Kellogg, executive director, the first executive director of the Marilla Opera Program. She comes to Marilla with some extensive background in the arts. She was the executive director of the Hilton Performing Arts Center at George Mason University in Manassas, Virginia, the director of education at Lyric Opera of Chicago, dean of the Levine School of Music in Washington, D.C., and she served on the administrative staffs of the Greater Miami Opera, now Florida Grand Opera, Chautauqua Opera, and Westminster Choir College. She's also been active as singer and coach accompanist for over 30 years. Very kind welcome to you, Jean.
Thank you so much for having us, and thank you for your support of Marilla.
Oh, we always look forward to it. Mojo is also with us. Mojo is a stage director based in New York City, has presented productions at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival, Williamstown Theater Festival, as well as the Glimmerglass Festival, Opera Theater Pittsburgh, Manhattan School of Music, among others. She was the winner of the 2013 biannual Opera America award for Director Designers Showcase, and she presented her new production concept of Carlisle Floyd's Susanna at the annual Opera Conference in Vancouver, Canada. The final model and renderings are on exhibit in the Design Showcase at the National Opera Center in New York City, where this fall she will join the Juilliard School as a directing fellow. A very kind welcome to you, Mo.
Thank you. Good afternoon. So glad to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you. Well, Jean, let's start with folks, even though they've been hearing about the Marilla program finale on KLW as our doing a media sponsorship, tell us what the Marilla program is.
Well, Marilla has been around now for 58 years, coming close to our 60th anniversary in a couple of years. And we are the premier opera training program pretty much in the world, I would say. We have artists coming from all over the world. Over between 800 and 1,000 people apply every year to be a part of Marilla. It's a 12-week intensive training program for singers, coach accompanists, and, of course, stage directors.
And it's quite a competitive program, isn't it?
Very competitive. Of those 800 to 1,000, we take 23 singers, 5 pianists, and 1 stage director. So, and it does, it's very competitive. We have the finest operatic training and teachers that come to Marilla every summer. This year, we always have Martin Katz and Warren Jones, Stephen Blyer as the coaches. This year, we had James Morris come and work with our singers, as well as Anne Murray from the British Isles. And Jane Eaglin, our famous Wagnerian soprano, has been coming for a number of years to work with them. So they really do get to work with the very best in the world.
And they turn out to be some of the very best in the world as well. Some of the alumni have gone on to some fantastic careers.
You look at anyone on the Met roster. You have Deborah Voigt, Joyce DiDonato, Thomas Hampson. It just goes on and on, who the big names that are out there now.
I want to check in with Mojo here to find out how she first got interested in opera to begin with.
Okay. It's a quite interesting story. I came to the States exact 10 years ago, 2005, August 16, for college. I went to Bowdoin up in Maine for undergrad, thinking I'm going to law school. And Bowdoin, as you know, is a top law school theater. I saw my first theater show in this country at American Repertory Theater in Boston. And the first show I saw was directed by M. Bogart, this very famous avant-garde director. I did not understand a thing, but I just feel like the moment I step out of the theater, I could never see the world the same. So I continued taking more theater classes back in college. And when I had my first directing class, I knew that's my calling. And 2 years later, after I saw that life-changing performance, I got into Columbia for MFA in directing. And guess who's running that program? Anne Bogart.
Oh,
so
wow.
She became my teacher. So this is how I got into directing. Opera is like, it's also kind of a serendipity, because Francesca Zambello came to our class first week at Columbia. And she actually said, you know, that I really believe the future of opera will be in China 10 years from now. This is where I'm originally from. Because she said, if you look at those young arts program, you have some of the best singers all from China, and you have this massive market there. Yet, we still don't have a very legit, serious Chinese opera director yet. And that's me sitting in the crowd and pointing and saying, no, Francesca, it's going to be me. So I deliberately, steering my focus back to opera. And the luxury of going to school in New York City is I got to go to the Metropolitan Opera at least two or three times a week.
Nice.
And so, yeah. So after that, just never look back.
So have you had an opportunity yet to bring your skills back to China?
Yes, not in the opera field. I was hired by Disney Shanghai earlier this year to do some very cutesy and commercial shows. That's what I've been referring.
Gotta pay the bills, Mo.
That's my corporate job. That's okay. My corporate job. Yeah. But we are talking about maybe potentially doing some opera over there next year. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, this showcase for you, a tremendous opportunity as an apprentice stage director. You're staging all of the works in the finale?
Yes.
And that must be... and a great opportunity to just plant seeds for your own future productions of each of these operas.
Yes, yeah. I'm telling you, it's when I was preparing it, it's like nightmare. It's because singer only need to learn the scenes, and for me, I need to basically learn 17 different operas. The entire, some of them are in Russian, so I was just literally going through every single word in Russian. So it's great. I actually get to know a lot of repertoire I've never touched before, and working on this process being such a great joy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of fun.
And you're in some great company with the fellow Marilini. Jean, I'm understanding that once these people are involved in the program, they're basically taken care of. Thanks to some generous sponsorship.
Absolutely. Once they're here, they all their housing, their transportation, their training, everything is paid for through Marilla and through our generous sponsors, like you said. And after that, we don't ignore them after they leave as well. We have career grants that we give to them for 5 years after they graduate from Marilla that enables them to go and do audition tours, take voice lessons, have headshots, whatever might be needed to enhance their career, as well as intensive language study over in Europe. Mm-hmm. So Marilla really does take care of its own. It's the only training program that actually offers the opportunity for them to sing leading roles, as well as have the training along with it. It's as well as the career grants on top of that. It's a unique program.
It's fantastic. Yeah. Now, this Saturday's performance at 7:30 at the Opera House is a laundry list of some really incredible opera scenes. Now, I know you can't show particular bias, but tell us about some of this year's Marilini.
Oh, well, we have quite some large voices in this group, as you can tell from their repertoire. We've got some Wagner singers. We have some amazing lower voices this year, as well as some superb mezzos and sopranos. It's incredible what we have coming here. And I will also say that we have some pretty spectacular pianists who have been involved all summer long as well. And some will be playing in the performances at the Marilla Grand Finale, but they've all been working with the Marilini and coaching them and training them on this. But yes, we have some, our artists are, some of them are leaving to go on to other great ventures, such as Houston Grand Opera, their training program. We have a finalist in the Stella Maris International Competition. One is going to the National Opera Studio in London.
One is going to Juilliard, the one we have here with us.
Exactly. Yes. And we have another who is going to be actually performing at L.A. Opera, singing Sharpless and Madama Butterfly in their 15-16 year, as well as Chouinard in La Boheme. So, yes, we have an amazing group of talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mo, I'm wondering if you could share with us, you've been involved in all of these scenes. What's been the most fun scene to stage?
The most fun. Oh, I must say it's the Falstaff drinking aria. Because here's the challenge. We are on the set of Sweeney Todd. So it's really tricky.
Right.
I'm inheriting someone else's design. And for me, creating this concert, it's always about creating a very coherent experience for the audience. So what I try to do is weave every single scene together, no matter how diverse or different, irrelevant they are together. So As you know, chorus time in opera is always very limited. So I only have literally 2 hours with all the boy to stage this like drunk body number. so we pull it through. It's very fun, and we do it in a tiny, teeny room with all the boys, and they just all show this very great. And we will literally do some method acting exercise. Please recall all of your frat experience. They just all bring up, raise the roof, and at some point say, "Boys, we need to tone down a little bit. It's a legit opera." Concert, so tone it down, Ted.
And stay away from the Sweeney Todd knives.
Yes.
the razors.
Oh, yes. Please. Yes.
Well, speaking of celebration and drinking, part of the Grand Marola finale is a reception afterwards, which we can learn about at the website, marola.org. So if you want to catch the performance, learn about what's all the many wonderful arias that are going to be seen and staged at the Opera House this coming Saturday, MEROLA.ORG. More information also at sfopera.com. Jean, what's next for you as part of Marola's next program? I mean, things must be already underway with recruitment.
Absolutely. We start with auditions in the fall. We do auditions in San Francisco, Houston, Chicago, and New York City. We spend 2 weeks in New York City because that's where many of our international artists come to audition. This year we have three Koreans, two Chinese, Italian, Russian. Who am I missing? Two New Zealanders and an Australian. So,
yeah.
So yes, they come from all over. So we are preparing for that. And as soon as those auditions are over, we offer them the opportunity to come to Marola. And after that, they are putting together the programs. The Schwabacher Summer Concert, if any of you went to that this year, it was spectacular, absolutely spectacular. There's a lot of our larger voices were in that. And we do not choose the repertoire for that until after we choose the singer. So we have two operas that we'll be doing next year. We are going to be doing Conrad Seuss's Transformations and Mozart's Così fan tutte.
Great.
So we will have people auditioning specifically for those roles. But there are other voices that are very interesting that don't fit into those particular roles. Then they go into the Schwabacher concert, and the repertoire is based upon what they are best at. So it's kind of a fun thing to do.
Right. Those concerts coming up at the Yerba Buena Center. Mm.
Right. Yes, they were. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. I thank you for coming in, Jean, for telling us a little bit about Marola and Mojo. We look forward to hearing more from your career as the years progress.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's go out with some music of Bernstein and Make Our Garden Grow from Candide. This is from the 2013 Marola Grand Finale. Thanks again for coming in. Questions about the Marola Opera Program can be answered at their website, marola.org. Still to come here on Open Air, a conversation with Jeff Nuttall of the St. Lawrence String Quartet, and Peter Robinson will be in with a review of Best of Enemies, the Vidal Buckley debate movie, as well as talking about the changing face of today's libraries. Music, choral music of a different sort next with my next guest, Mr. Kellogg. That's the music of Slavyanka. They're going to be performing Rachmaninoff's All Night Vigil, his Vespers, on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday here in San Francisco, as well as Palo Alto and Berkeley. With me now is Paul Andrews, founding director of Slavyanka. Paul led the group from 1979 until 1991, and again as interim director back in 2012 during the search for the new permanent director. And he now acts as president and chairman of the board. Paul, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
It's such a lovely sound. There's nothing quite like it, is there? Tell us a little bit about that tradition of that part of the world and choral music.
Well, actually, what you heard a moment ago is the male choir of Slavyanka, which Slavyanka was a male choir for 33 years of its history. The Vespers will actually be performed by a choir of 100 voices, and we'll hear a little bit more of that music in a moment. Russia comes out of a very different, it's a very different spiritual continent than the West. It comes out of a very different history, and the Orthodox churches provide a very different basis for culture than the churches in the West. I think that's part of what you hear. There's a kind of otherworldly quality to it when we Westerners listen. That's quite remarkable, and it comes out of that history, really.
What I didn't realize is the name Slavyanka is the name of what Americans have called the Russian River.
That's correct. That's what the Russian colonists in Fort Ross, I think most people know that there were Russian colonists who came to Fort Ross in California and tried to make a go of growing vegetables for their Alaska colonies, and it tried for 30 years. But yes, you're right. That's the name that they gave to what we call the Russian River.
Slavyanka. Now, tell me how these different choral coalitions have come together for this particular performances.
Lots of cajoling and bribery and overhand and underhanded techniques to round up 100 singers, many of them on vacation from other groups. There are a lot of groups that don't perform during the summer, and we've been lucky enough to recruit many of them to come and join us, including some marvelous basses just outstanding singers that we've been able to put together. So this is, I think, all attracted by what you're saying, that this is a very different music, and it has a kind of emotional and spiritual depth that's unique.
Well, let's talk specifically about this work by Rachmaninoff, which was first performed in 1915.
Correct.
Some 2 years later, with the Russian Revolution, there would be a ban on all religious music of any kind by any composer in Russia.
Yes, and I should say that Rachmaninoff wrote the Vespers in 2 weeks, if you can believe such a thing. And he wrote it actually at the height of what's called the golden age of religious of church music in Russia. It was the only comparable piece, I think, is Bach's B minor Mass, you know, which is this enormous liturgical piece. It's the setting of the Mass, but it's obviously meant for more than Sunday service. Mm-hmm. You not do the Bach B minor at your average Sunday service. So it has that feeling, and it's a culmination of so many, and a synthesis of so many different elements from the, Rachmaninoff was terribly sensitive to both the ancient traditions, the old chants going back 1,000 years, and the modern techniques of composition for which he's better known. And to synthesize all of that in this piece was just this remarkable achievement. And as you point out, 2 years later, there was a huge change in Russia, not only in Russia, but also in Rachmaninoff's personal life. He had to leave Russia. He came, as you probably know, to America, and had a career here, which is more about performance than composition then, and didn't do much choral writing after that, but mostly instrumental mm-hmm. that he's better known
for. Well, let's hear a little bit of the opening of the Vespers, and then we'll talk more about these performances and more about Rachmaninoff in particular. What are we going to hear in this opening?
This is called Prijditia Poklonimsia, which is a call to worship. Come, let us worship. And so it's appropriate to have that as our opening piece.
And then more with Paul Andrews in just a moment. Call to Worship from Rachmaninoff's Vespers, Opus 37, here with Paul Andrews, who is the president of Slavyanka, who is presenting this massive work Friday in Palo Alto, Saturday here in San Francisco, and Sunday in Berkeley. Paul, you brought a very special recording that we're listening to. Tell us about the recording that you brought.
Yes, this is a recording by the USSR State Academic Choir. It's commonly known as the Sveshnikov Choir, which is the name of the director at the time the recording was made. And it was really the first recording of this piece, authentic recording, made since the 1915, 1916, because, of course, during the Soviet period, there was a big, any kind of religious performance was at a minimum frowned upon. So this was really quite a monumental achievement in Russia that Sveshnikov took this on. And I have to say, in 1986, Slavyanka actually made our first tour of the then Soviet Union, and we met with this choir in Moscow, and we met the soloists there, we met the singers. It was wonderful. We had a joint rehearsal with them. And of course, you know, they there are 30 of us. We sang for them, then they sang for us and blew us out of the room. They rehearse 40 hours a week.
Oh, my gosh.
They are the Robert Shaw Chorale of the, arguably the Robert Shaw Chorale of the Soviet Union.
Wow.
I think partly because the church was so frowned upon, I think that's part of what drew many, many Russians into classical culture, because that was the highest spiritual expression available.
All you have to do is ban something and people want to do it.
Don't spread the word.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Don't think of white and pink.
But,
pink
you know, when great political leaders would die, for example, they would put classical music. We would have maybe, you know, a psychologist or a religious person, but there would be classical music that would be in the background. So I think that's part of it.
And this work by Rachmaninoff is just amazing in that there's at some points 11 part harmonies going on. I don't even know how
yes.
that's possible.
Well, good. Yeah,
we hope
it's possible too. We have one more rehearsal. The what's really quite remarkable about the piece is, of course, the old chants were, you know, simple chant lines. And what Rachmaninoff did is he took those chant lines and began to layer them, sort of, you know, sort of an acoustical baklava is what we're creating here, sort of layer upon layer. And so you have three or four lines happening at the same time.
And just as tasty, yeah.
Well, just sonically. Equally tasty for, you know, and more nourishing probably. but just this incredible kind of ability to take the old chants and then work in modern techniques and make a new statement out of the old. This was very much the preoccupation of the people at this time period. Mm. Since, you know, people know Glinka and Mussorgsky and who were trying to recover this older material that had been lost or at least not suppressed, but sort of downplayed during the time of Peter the Great brought in all the Western European, and a lot of people said, no, let's go back, let's find what's really indigenous to Russia. And it was out of that movement that this whole liturgical development happened, of rediscovering the old spiritual treasure chest that is that, mm. that you that all of us are sort of uniquely touched by.
And Rachmaninoff himself wanted one of the movements from the Vespers to be performed at his funeral.
That's correct. So there's this really interesting kind of development that happens around that time with all these with all that effort. He was very aware of the old ancient traditions, as I said before.
Paul, we've got to get a quick word in about your new current director, Irina Shashneva.
Yes, splendid. She trained in Nizhny Novgorod, Gorky, and then studied in Moscow in 1991 and had a very successful career as a conductor and teacher and in Russia. And then in 1991 came to Boston, started a number of musical ventures there, were highly successful. And we're just thrilled that since for the last 3 years, she's been director of Slavyanka. And she's really introduced just a tremendous amount of new repertoire and just knows choral singing inside and out. So we're just delighted that she's our director.
Fantastic. And you've planted some wonderful seeds yourself for the many years that you've led the chorus.
Well, it fertilized the ground anyway.
There you go. Yeah, there you go. Yeah. We're going to hear one final movement, and it is the final movement from the Rachmaninoff Vespers. Tell us about that.
Yeah. Yes, this is a Greek chant, and it's a hymn to the Virgin Mary. And as you can hear, it's quite different in feeling. Rachmaninoff drew on many, many traditions from Russian church music, among them Greek and Kievan, these different kinds of chants. And so this is a very joyful kind of ending to the piece.
Thank you, Paul Andrews, for coming in to talk about these performances by Slavyanka.
Yes, just very quickly, Friday, August 21st in Palo Alto, Saturday evening at Grace Cathedral in San Francisco, and Sunday at First Congregational Church in Berkeley. And our website is www.slavyankachorus.org. That's slavyankachorus.org. And there's lots more information, and there may be a few tickets left online.
Excellent.
Hope not for long.
Well, thanks again for coming in, Paul. Complete performance of Rachmaninoff's All Night Vigil, or Vespers, Opus 37, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, from Slavyanka, and guest choristers. Information at slavyankachorus.org. Well, music director Michael Tilson-Thomas leads the San Francisco Symphony in 13 concerts across 9 cities and some of Europe's most prestigious concert halls and festivals, the 27th of this month through September 14th. Included in the retinue are pianists Yujiao Wang and Jeremy Dank, and the St. Lawrence String Quartet will join the symphony throughout the tour for performances, including 2 concerts at the BBC Proms, 2 at the Edinburgh Festival, 2 at Lucerne, and at the Georgianescu Festival in Bucharest, as well as performances in Germany at the Berlin Festival and the Rheingau Festival in Wiesbaden, also at the Concertgebouw Luxembourg's Philharmonie, and the San Francisco Symphony will be making their debut at the new Paris Philharmonie. Central to the repertoire for the tour is the orchestra's Grammy Award-winning SFS Media Recording Catalog, Mahler's Symphony No. 1, Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4, and from the American Mavericks recording, Henry Cowell's Piano Concerto with Jeremy Dank, who will be performing it with the orchestra at London's BBC Proms. The European tour will also highlight the orchestra's newest media recording, performances of Bay Area composers John Adams' Absolute Jest, a work that was commissioned and recorded by MTT, just released last week, and features the St. Lawrence String Quartet. Established in 1989, the St. Lawrence String Quartet has developed an undisputed reputation as one of the world's great ensembles. In addition to performances around the world, the quartet has served as ensemble in residence at Stanford University since 1998. Later in the season, the quartet will tour on their own with performances at Carnegie Hall, Vancouver, and Toronto, among other cities. And the quartet is cellist Christopher Costanza, new violinist Owen Dalby, and Jeff Nuttall. Jeff, who with violist Leslie Robertson are founding members of the quartet. And Jeff joins me now by phone. Hi, Jeff.
Hi.
Boy, this is going to be quite an experience for you guys.
Oh, what a trip. Man, it's so much fun. I got to say, the last time was one of my great moments of my life, musically speaking. We got to play Absolute Jest at the South Playhouse, one of the last concerts before intermission, and then you go out after and listen to MTT and the San Fran guys play Berlioz Symphony Fantastique in Paris. It was just, it was tremendous.
So, oh my gosh.
So much fun for us to go on tour and hang out with amazing musicians and play this super cool piece.
Well, John Adams has called the string quartet plus orchestra model a repertory black hole. Are you working with other composers to remedy this?
Well, yeah, we've had a great Canadian composer, Marie Schaefer, wrote a piece for us called 440. And, I mean, truthfully, the whole concept of string quartet is this intimate, you know, powerful expression in a small space. And so a lot of, I mean, Absolute Jest is really a showpiece for the orchestra, you know, celebrating their 100th season. It's an incredible virtuoso display for the orchestra, and we're along for the ride. So I think, you know, what John means is that string quartet is not really designed to be played in these 3,000-seat halls and et cetera. But there are moments of you know, focused string quartet writing, but for the most part, it's an orchestral showpiece, and we're just hanging out.
Right. Well, Absolute Jest was written in 2013, inspired by Beethoven quartets, including some little creative bits of John's. Tell us more about the work itself.
Well, that's the genius of John, is his ability to totally steal from Beethoven without, you know, most composers would be quaking in their boots, but he steals so well, and somehow he manages to take Beethoven and turn it into Adams in such a remarkable way. It's a, you know, the great Stravinsky quote, I always think about this, he said, good composers borrow and great composers steal, and John has stolen in the best possible sense of the word, and it's really, I mean, the quartet aspects of this piece are really, a lot of the licks are from late Beethoven string quartets. That's the most audibly identifiable Beethoven bits in the piece.
And what? Tell me about your personal relationship with John Adams and the quartet's relationship.
Well, it goes back quite a way. We've been really lucky and been a big fan of his for many years, but he didn't really write a lot of chamber music. And he came to a show where we did his Book of Alleged Dances, and I'd known him and done some work with him through the years. And he said, hey, I want to write a quartet. And so that was the first string quartet. And then we were recording that, and I could just see he's like a kid in the candy shop. He had this, I got an idea. And so that was Absolute Jest, and we're going to be premiering this. You know, we've already premiered his second quartet already. So there's been three big works for string quartet, and we've just been really lucky and excited to be part of it.
Well, the symphony just released on their own media label a recording of Absolute Jest that was made with your former second violinist, Scott St. John, as part of the quartet, along with John Adams' grand pianola music. We're going to hear the final movement of Absolute Jest, the Prestissimo movement. What can you tell us about it?
That's scary. No, it's incredibly exciting. And there's a lick that he steals from the Waldstein Sonata, although it's sort of hard to tell, but an incredible build-up to it. And then a whimsical ending, which is really funny, with this sort of mistuned piano and harp. And so the whole it's the glint in the eye, you know, the humor in Beethoven, a lot of this piece, as well as tremendous virtuoso writing for quartet and orchestra.
Well, let's hear it now, but let me say goodbye to you, Jeff, and I wish you a wonderful tour, not only with the symphony, but with the quartet. Sounds like you've got some great venues that you're going to be performing
this coming
season.
Fun on the road, and thanks for having me.
Well, let's have you and the quartet live in the studio sometime soon.
Oh, that'd be super cool.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Music of John Adams now from Absolute Jest, being toured with the San Francisco Symphony as part of their European tour starting shortly.
Thank you.
movement that violinist Jeff Nuttall of the St. Lawrence String Quartet calls scary. Prestissimo from Absolute Jest. That was the San Francisco Symphony conducted by Michael Tilson Thomas with the St. Lawrence String Quartet. Absolute Jest is a work that's going to be on tour with the San Francisco Symphony as they do their European tour with the St. Lawrence String Quartet as part of their guest retinue, along with Yuja Wang and Jeremy Dank. And there's a couple of Bon Voyage concerts if you'd like to hear some of the repertoire that they're doing in Europe. On Friday, Schoenberg's Theme and Variations, Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 4 with Yuja Wang, and Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony. And then on Saturday evening, the second piano concerto of Béla Bartók also being taken on tour, and Mahler's First Symphony. Information about these weekend concerts, as well as the upcoming San Francisco Symphony Tour at sfsymphony.org. Good afternoon. I'm David LaTulip. You're listening to our Performing Arts Radio Magazine, Open Air. Happy to welcome back to the airwaves once again Peter Robinson. Hey, Peter.
Hey, David. Good to be here. I think it's actually called Absolute Jest because nobody quite knows when it was going to finish. And I counted at least four endings there. And I'm sure everybody was on their toes to say, is that the note? And they left hanging. But I was thinking, too, just of those words, absolute jest, because to me, this has been a summer of good documentaries, if not necessarily good movies. And the one I'm going to focus on is called Best of Enemies, not the best of friends, the best of enemies, which is actually about two absolute jesters. And I say that because I'm talking here about William Buckley and Gore Vidal.
Ultimate raconteurs.
That's right, raconteur. People of bon mots. They could dish it out, and in this case, dish it up to each other. Now, to put this particular broadcast, because it did start as a series of 10 broadcasts in Chicago during the presidential convention in 1968. I think it's important to see the context of 1968 to understand how ABC chose this as a medium for upping the ratings at the television series. So 1968, of course, is the year that Nixon enters the primaries at New Hampshire. It's also the year of the Tet Offensive. It's the year that both Ted Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy are part of the political arena. It's also the year of the My Lai massacre. Now, there you have any one of those happenings as a major news incident, which in fact would condition the year because, of course, Chicago became a street of bloods under Mayor Daley. And it's against that background that this television debate between Gore Vidal and William Buckley took place. And the title, Best of Enemies, these two gentlemen loathed each other. And so from the beginning, I think the premise, if I was going to describe it, is that if two people agree, one of them is superfluous. And here we go, with all the gloves off in what could have been otherwise very close to a boxing match.
And I understand the film itself is very well done. It's not just a dry documentary.
That's right. They have interesting cuts which help you understand both the context and the psychology of the two debaters. Buckley, of course, was famous for Firing Line, a extreme right-wing, but a deep philosophical magazine which had an ideology to go with it. He was also part of the National Review, so you bring that perspective there. And Gore Vidal, whose book Myra Brackenidge had already set the world on fire, a very funny, humorous book with a serious content, had early on recognised that whatever sexual leanings mattered, he was not in any way hiding behind any curtain. And I think that, to me, is also important, because when we look at the way the gender revolution has evolved, he was definitely courageous and ahead of his game. So as the debates continue, we get wordsmiths. Wordsmiths at their best exercising what I call the joy of the English language, but we also get theatre. And the reason I think these debates and this particular documentary were so important is that it actually set the tone for future, what I call the argument culture on television when it came to debating. If we look at the three networks back in 1968, CBS, NBC, ABC was the last, it was the lowest in rating, and suddenly this turned everything round. And when the main confrontation came, where Gore Vidal actually called Buckley a crypto-Nazi, and Buckley himself retorts using the word queer, you could see that the venom was flying in the room, and it really set listeners on fire. I often think of that phrase of Noel Coward, the extraordinary high potency of cheap music, because this, as I say, was not just philosophical, it was personal, and it came very close to blows. From Buckley's point of view, he had been the sophisticated, calm questioner on Firing Line, and what Gore Vidal successfully did was extract him from that persona. And whether Gore Vidal won the debate, he may have won the moment, Buckley himself would go on to survive. And in a sense, Buckley's legacy has given the philosophy behind much of the conservative thinking that is still with us today. And equally, from Gore Vidal's point of view, he set the stage for the future in terms of the sexual revolution and the understanding that was so needed. So I highly recommend this particular documentary. I think it's a useful piece of social history. It's certainly an important part of television history. And I might just add as a footnote that if you enjoyed 20 Feet from Stardom, the story about these background singers, it is the same people who made that who have made the Best of Enemies. It's screening in Marin, it's screening here in the city. Don't miss it. It's a great piece of filmmaking.
Looking forward to catching The Best of Enemies here in the Bay Area right now. It's at the Embarcadero Center Cinemas and at the California Theater at on Kittredge Street in Berkeley.
Now, also, these last few weeks, I've been looking at what I call the changing face of libraries and how libraries have always been important in our lives, but they've now kind of reached out to perform what I call an even extended social function. To me, they've always been a place for information, obviously for books. As I live in Marin, as a journalist, I've been often very dependent on the reference desk at the Sausalito Library for the great thing we always have to do, but you never see happen, fact-checking. So let me give you a couple of examples. This week, at least, I'm going to use Marin Libraries as my stepping stone. The Mill Valley Library, starting this weekend on Saturday and Sunday and running for the next 4 weeks, is the setting for The Taming of the Shrew. This is an interesting part of summer Shakespeare. It takes place actually at the back of the library on the edge of the woods. And I haven't been yet because opening night isn't until this coming weekend, but in the previous years I've been. And I think in many ways this is very close to how Shakespeare may have performed his plays, in an open-air setting, very basic scenery. And, of course, The Taming of the Shrew is that great story about Kate. It became the basis for Cole Porter's Kiss Me, Kate. And it is both a humorous and, at the same time, relevant piece of writing about the status of women, the relationship of men and women, the meaning of love, and of course, who is right and who is wrong. It's free. So again, you're getting a special occasion at the Mill Valley Library, downtown Mill Valley, starting Saturday in the afternoon at 2:30 and running for the next 4 weekends. Now, if you move down the road to Tiburon, they have been screening something which is part of the Tiburon International Film Festival, and the upcoming one called Khrushchev in America. Again, interesting documentary about the famous visit when Khrushchev came to this country. But I think more important, it shows the role that libraries are playing in our lives as a way of bringing communities together. The other thing I like to go to on a Thursday at the beginning of each month at the Tiburon Library is afternoon tea. And it's a way of introducing residents to the library. And I think what better way? Sit down, nice cup of tea. Tea and crumpets, of course.
Very nice.
Strawberries and cream. And Bob's your uncle. So, again, I think this is an interesting extended role of how libraries have changed or are changing our lives. And in September, at the Sausalito Library, we're still staying in Marin, there is a series which is put on by the San Francisco Literary Society called Love and Betrayal in Graham Greene Movies. So here we have The Third Man, The Quiet American, and, of course, Our Man in Havana and The End of the Affair. Now, if you want more information, I'll quickly give a phone number, area code 415-381-6671. That is the San Francisco Literary Society, for a list of interesting happenings at libraries. Again, 415-381-6671.
Thanks, Peter. We look forward to your next dispatch on Open Air.
Thank you.
I'll never forget the day I read a book. It was contagious, 70 pages. There were pictures here and there, so it wasn't hard to bear. The day I read a book. It's a shame I don't recall the name of the book. It wasn't a history, I know, because it had no plot. It wasn't a mystery, because nobody there got shot. The day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm gonna do it again. Why, if you walk into my house, you'll see loads of books. And believe me, they're not there just for appearances. I press an awful lot of butterflies. I know reading is relaxing. What did Napoleon do for relaxation? He read a book. What did Lincoln do for relaxation? He read a book. What does Congress do for relaxation? They book a read. You know, I'm familiar with all the bestsellers. There's the Encyclopedia Britannia, Forever Umbriago, and a new piece of significant literature which says, Atka Gretka Batka, Setka Engelafa, Ala Mali Shui. How do you like that? I've been reading the life story of Mumbles. But I love good reading. Why, last week I spent 2 solid days in the library. Much to my regret, I buried my nose in a book, and what happened? I forgot which book I buried it in. A catastrophe. It wasn't a history, I know, because it had no plot. It wasn't a mystery, because nobody there got shot. One day I read a book, I can't remember when, but one of these days I'm going to do it again. Yes, sir. One of these days I'm going to do it again.
The great Jimmy Durante rounding things off here on Open Air for this Thursday, August 20th, 2015. I'm David LaTulipe, your host. Information about the guests on today's show will be posted at klw.org shortly. And you can hear all past Open Airs at our website, klw.org. My thanks, as always, to volunteer producer Neil Swinkles for herding cats and keeping the calendar as clean and full as possible. Join me again next week at the same time for Open Air. Show suggestions? Send me an email, david@klw.org.